All right, now I'd like to introduce Ed Smith, Overcoming Communication Barriers in Your Supply Chain. This is the perfect guy for this subject. So.
Thanks. Absolutely. There you go, buddy. Hootie engineers in the room. I love you guys, and I'm not going to irritate you like the last guy said he was going to do. But, you know, interestingly enough, I've been on both sides of this issue multiple times in my career. I've been on the manufacturing side in the early 2000s when the dot-com bust happened. And if you remember then, there was a huge obsolescence issue because companies weren't profitable, things happened. Then I went on the distribution side and did that and listened to our customers complain how they couldn't get certain parts at certain times, sometimes the speed to market. And now I'm back on the manufacturing side and building different products, building medical products, building military products, building test and measurement products. And I always say, it doesn't matter if it's a penny part that goes obsolete or a $100 FPJ that goes obsolete, it still could cost you that $7 million cost avoidance that I heard a few minutes ago. So it doesn't matter what type of part it is. What matters is it could scuttle a whole program, it could stop something from happening, and it may not be recoverable in some cases. They asked me to talk about communication, and what you'll immediately find out about communication, there's a lot of different types of communication. There's people to people, there's people to machine, there's machine to machine. And if you have bad data, guess what happens through all of that communication? Bad things. And so we'll talk about all those, how to try to overcome that, how to try to keep it focused, and all of that. So with that, the first thing I thought you'd want to know is what is the definition of communication? That's pretty simple. Imparting, exchanging information, news, ideas, things like that. Seems simple enough, right? And then you say, oh, but when I have an idea and starts in marketing, we're going to make a product. And so the marketing guys come to some of you and say, hey, Mr. Engineer, can you make this product? How easy? What does it cost? Anybody think that communication all the way down that line will be easy? Not a marketing person. Goes to engineering. Engineering says, yeah, we can make it. It'll cost this. Marketing says, hey, I can only sell it if it costs this. Can you re-engineer it? They now take some risks. They take parts out. They do things. And all of a sudden, now there's risk in this situation. Then they go to the supply chain. Can we find somebody to build it? Can we build it internally? What can we do? They then go to purchasing. Hey, can you buy some of this stuff? Purchasing then goes to either an OEM direct or a disti. Anybody know how long that process takes? Weeks. Biggest issue I've ever had in my career is I came out of a world early in my career where I worked for W.W. Grainger. Anybody know W.W. Grainger? Okay. How quickly do you get the price and availability? Within seconds. They either have it in stock, they don't have it in stock, and you get a price at that moment. I never understood when I came to the electronics business where people would say, hey, that will take me 10 days to get you a price. My answer is 10 days, that's an eternity for customers. And so it takes time. Then the OEM sends it back to their business unit. Their business unit says, what should be our price? What should be our delivery? How many are they going to buy? Do we have the capability to build this over a long period of time? Then it goes to planning at the OEM. Then it goes to the manufacturing group at the OEM. It's really, and then here's the greatest. I deal with this every day. I have a question. I don't understand the BOM. The part's missing some number. Where does it go? All the way back to the beginning, and this whole process starts over, and a lot of time and effort is wasted. And it seems like it should be very simple communication, but it is very complicated. Anybody have an idea what the average time to go from marketing concept all the way through the purchasing is? I'll use this better. Non-military, non-aerospace, non-avionics. If you were Apple and you were going to go from product with a marketing concept to fulfillment, anybody know the average time? 6 months? It's not too far off. It's 7.5 months, and that's a commercial product. Anybody know if they decide to change the TCAS, TAS on an airplane, how long that takes?
Years.
So this communication looks simple, right? This little diagram, I put this diagram together and said, oh, this is simple. And then I said, if you put time limits to all of this, so now I get to the end. It's 7.5 months, or it's years. You think the data is the same as when it started in the marketing concept? things change. Parts go obsolete. Companies get bought. Interesting enough about the speed of companies getting bought, it's not only companies getting bought, but the technologies change. Does anybody know the speed of how quickly fabs and technologies are changing in the fabs? Right now, going from nanometers, I just was at a presentation over in Europe where they were showing the latest product at 3 nanometers. It is unbelievable. And so you can't be building old type products next to new type products. So what happens? They obsolete the old, they move to the new. So this communication takes months, sometimes years, to get from beginning to end. Seems simple, but I'm going to break it down even further. Internal to the customer, you have marketing comes up with an idea. And it may not be even a new idea. It may be changing an old idea. Hey, the FAA has a new mandate. We need to change the cockpit recorder. We need to do this. We need to change some of our stuff. Engineering says, okay, I can do that. Great. They go to supply chain. Supply chain says, wait, hold on a second. They're not going to make that part for 10 years. We need to be able to service our customer for 10 years. Oh, let's go back to engineering. Change the part. Let's go back to supply chain. We now have it redesigned. We go to purchasing. Hey, we need to go buy it. Do we make it internal? Do we make it external? We then start moving to the outside world. I put down below that some tools that could help you. This is life cycle tools. You just heard Vern talk a little bit about silicon experts. But there's other tools in terms of life cycle. What's going on? What's happening in the world? And as accurate as these tools are, by the time you get to market, things can change. And it's really a difficult situation. But I would tell you, besides just the tool, like a life cycle tool, if you keep your eyes open in the marketplace, you can see what's going on. You know, the MLCC thing I found interesting a couple years ago. So last year we grew 50% year on year in the middle of an MLCC. I'm in the EMS space, so if I didn't say that, CEO of an EMS company. We grew 50%. People would say to me, how did you grow 50%? And my answer was, as soon as I saw the MLCC thing start, I bought every MLCC we needed for our customers for 2 years, and I bought it in advance. It's kind of like obsolescence, right? I made an investment. All of a sudden, our customers could grow. They didn't have to wait for the lead times. They didn't have to go. But you have to have that data. And the way I got the data, I used to sit on a board of ECIA, and I had become the CEO, and they still sent me those emails. It's always pretty cool. I'm still getting my old emails. I'm like, holy cow, there's a problem in the MLCC world. Let's buy the parts. My supply chain guys are like, no, don't worry. If we forecast them, the distributors will hold them for us. And my answer is, what? Like, what world do you live in? We pay 1 penny for a part. Somebody will go pay them $1, and guess what? All of a sudden, we'll call up. What's the word I learned in the MLCC crisis? You always learn new terminology. What's the new word that I learned in the MLCC crisis? Decommit. I'm going to decommit. Now, if I wasn't in public here, I'd tell you what that really means. But since I'm in public, I'll give you the washed out version, which is, hey, I'm not going to deliver and you're screwed. Because when you have to get a new commitment, guess what? You've already lost all the lead time for the first commitment. And that's brutal. Really, really brutal. And so you need life cycle tool. The second part of it, an internal that you can really help yourself a lot, is if you have good production planning. You go have communication with your customer, your end customer. How many of these do you need and when do you need them? You know what forecast accuracy in the industry is? Anybody have any idea what forecast accuracy? So I used to be the president of Avnet, so I will tell you that. So it's always funny. I appreciate the Arrow guys inviting me, and I love the Arrow guys now. Just in case you didn't catch up with that. A couple of years ago, they would have never invited me, and I probably wouldn't have come anyway. But forecast planning, our customers, so now I'm in the EMS business, and I deal with the military, and they say, I'll never forget this. A customer just told me this a couple weeks ago. I know what I need for the next 5 years. I know exactly what I need. I know what I need to deliver to them for the next 5 years. And my answer is, no way. Because if I took your forecast to what you think you need, it will be different. And it will change quarter on quarter. It'll go up, it'll go down. It'll go up, it'll go down. Anybody talk to their boss in this room and their boss says, I can't believe we're short. We know what we build. Every month we build 10 of these. And then you go show them that, no, you don't. Some months you build 20, some months you build 5. So you need a good production forecast planning system. DFX. So this is used in the EMS space a lot and in the manufacturing space. It's designed for X, manufacturing, supply chain, cost, whatever it would be that you're trying to design for. So there are times where I could say to a customer, I can save you 10% on your product. But here's the risk. The risk is these parts may not be made in 2 years. Well, why not? Because that company just got bought by this other company, and there is risk that this product line won't move forward. When they make acquisitions, so Broadcom, Avago bought Broadcom, probably one of the most incredible acquisitions ever. Anybody know why? Avago was little. They were able to borrow $39 billion. It's mind-numbing to me, right? I had been out to dinner with Hawk, and he says, yeah, Ed, I'm going to go borrow $36 billion. I'm like, I went home that night saying, I think he drank too much. Next thing you know, he bought it. But what was the first thing that they said in their announcement? We are going to focus on these products. Now, if you had designed in these products, what should you have known right away? They're at grave risk, right? They're either not making enough money or they're going to stop making them or the technology doesn't exist. So you have to do DFX. Proto-buys. I always find the proto-buy thing interesting. Many of the problems come out during the proto-buy, right? You go to buy it, lead times are long, something's wrong, quality's not as good. But the proto-buy, if you pay attention to proto-buy, it's where a lot of issues come out. And the last but not least, there is a lot of data exchanged. Somebody said about the bombs and the bombs information. Do you know when we get a quote, 95% of the quotes we get don't have all the information we need to quote something. The bombs are incomplete, the drawings are incomplete, something's not happening. And my answer to that is, it works well in a portal because you say, if I don't have this, 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 and this, but as soon as you use the human element there, and I'll talk about the human element in a second, things go wrong. And if these things break down, right next to it, you'll see the breakdown, the ways to overcome them. You have brokers. Sometimes that works pretty simply. Hey, I'll go out in the market, I'll find it. Sometimes you have end-of-life companies you need to go out and buy things from. I had a customer, I won't tell you the name because I don't want to embarrass them, but they had about $40 million of end-of-life components in stock. And the way I know it was $40 million is they asked me to buy it and hold it for them. And when you talk about cost of obsolescence, that $40 million has an interest cost, a holding cost, an insurance cost. And so this is why when somebody asked on this side of the thing, what is the true cost avoidance? You have to take all those costs of what it would be to cost to avoid. Sometimes the lead times are too long. Do you know if the lead time's too long, a lot of cases, you miss the market. Hey, if I got to wait 26 weeks, my competitor will get to the market because they designed a different part in it. And they'll beat me to the market. And then last but not least, this is kind of interesting. Purchasing gets a PCN. How many times has this happened? Purchasing gets an EPN, PCN, or supply chain, and it doesn't get back to engineering. And by the time the PCN gets back through, somebody says, we need to buy that part. Oh, it's end of life. But you were notified 6 months ago. How many times has that happened in your company? I'm sure once or twice. Now you have to add the outside world, which you don't control, which makes communication even more difficult. You're now communicating with the DISTI. The DISTI only has a certain amount of information. They have to go to the factory. It's not a one-day process to do that. They have to go to the BU. Could you still make it? Do you still have masks? Do you have any dye left? What can possibly happen? You have the planning at the factory that will go look and do that. Can you manufacture it? Do we still have the right equipment to manufacture? Do we still have, most manufacturers today don't manufacture the whole part. They use houses to do the end, to do the packaging and different things. Now we got to go to the packaging company, right? So add another one to here, the packaging company or the end process of the company. That becomes some communication that sometimes breaks down. You know why it breaks down? We all don't speak the same language. I know that's hard to believe, but it goes over to Asia, and sometimes in communication they say yes, they don't really mean yes. They mean, yes, I heard you, yes, I want to do that, but no, I'm not capable. They don't finish that last little bit that we in Europe and America would expect. And so you have tools for that too, EDI, you have quote tools, you have ERPs, all of you use different tools for all these different things. But when they break down, you have some alternatives. Once again, you go to brokers, life cycles, parts. And then I put down recertification. I deal with a lot of customers that if they had to recertify their product, it would be expensive. Everybody deal with that in this room? But more than being expensive in terms of cost, if you have to recertify your product and it takes a year, and you're out of that product line in a year, what could happen to that product line? It could go away. That market could be taken over by one of your competitors. They can cannibalize your market. So, as you can tell, you have your internal conversation going on, then you have your external conversation. So you need to take some considerations in of what you need to do when you communicate. Some of the things you have to say to yourself, hey, we have this product, it's gonna go end of life. And you say, should we revive the product? Can we go to the supplier and get them to revive the product? Can they still make it? If they can still make it, will they still make it? Can they still make it? Are they technically capable of making it? I have had the worst luck where a factory says, I'm going to remake something. And I say, great. And then the yield is 40%. And guess what that means? I'm not so sure I trust the parts that come to you. Because if they're only getting 40% yield, you could have latent failure somewhere deep in the part, somewhere. So can they still make it? Is there some left in the channel that somehow you can borrow? Is there a replacement? This is the thing in the industry I was always bothered most by. We end the life parts because we say technology continues to get better. I'm not so sure why they don't make that same part with better technology. Die shrink it, do different things. Why the part or the technology has to completely go away? Is it worth to redesign, recertify? And in all the governmental regulations, are there enough government regulations for all of you in this room? It is crazy. The other interesting thing that you'll find here on the government regulations is this whole thing with, is it certified, is it not, you know, what type of chips are you looking for? If you made the chip, would it be considered counterfeit or not counterfeit? These things have gone around for a long time. And then the easiest part for people is to not revive a project. The unfortunate part is we sign many contracts that say we have a life span of whatever years, 5 years, 10 years, and the product needs to be made. So here are the overall issues in communication. It is complex. When Rob first asked me to talk about communication, I sat down and go, oh, this is gonna be easy. And then I started thinking about each part of it and I go, if I broke it down, I could spend 5 hours talking about each portion of it and how things can go wrong and what you need to fix. It is very complex. The time frames, most frustrating thing in the industry to me, how long it takes to get information back and forth from customer to us, all the way to supplier and then back. It's not hours, it's not minutes, it's days, weeks, and months, and that can't be right to me. So I think the time frames is an issue in the industry. Multiple parties. Not only is it that sometimes simple to say, hey, we can do that or we can't do that, but there's multiple parties involved. There's the government that's involved, the FDA that's involved. Multiple parties, people build parts. So if you build for a plane, you may build only one part of a plane. And obviously there's other parts that this could affect. So you have multiple parties. The rate of change is not going to slow down. I do not see in the industry any slowdown or rate of change. We will get to 3 nanometer or smaller in the next 5 years. Once again, there's all kinds of goodness and badness to that. Chips will continue to get slower. Smaller. They'd go out of their minds hearing that. But as they get smaller and smaller, there's different issues you have to deal with. There's heat, there's speed, there's all kinds of different things, and the rate of change will continue. And then you have what I think is the most critical or difficult, the types of communication. You have human to human. Worst part of communication is human to human. We could play a game here. If I had a little more time, I would play a little game with you where I could tell you something and have you write it down. And then I would take every one of you and write down what you thought you heard. You know what the chances of 100% of you hearing what I said to be accurate? Zero. People hear differently than other people speak. Human to human is the most risky of anything. Human to machine is risky. If humans put bad information into great processes and great machines, what happens? A bad result. So you need to check the information, make sure you have the correct information to go in. And then you have machine to machine, which is with good information and timely information, the quickest, most accurate, but also the most dangerous. Because if somebody doesn't check that information, what could happen? Oh, no, that's perfect. Don't worry, we don't need to look at that. When you finally do look at it, guess what it normally is? A critical juncture, and normally not time to recover. So with that, I say it this way. My good friend talked about people first. I actually think people are most important. I would agree with him. But you have to have a robust process. Just by you being here tells me your companies already understand obsolescence and needs to have a robust process. You need to have good people that fit it. They want to do it. They're not doing it just because they have to do it. And then last, when all of that fails, I think your companies have to have a great relationship with the people who can make a difference, the BUs. When you're starting to make a new product, meet with the BUs at the OEM. Make sure they're bought in, that they'll keep the key technologies running for as long as your product is. And with that, I want to thank you for your time. I could have went on for hours on all of this.
President and CEO of SMTC, Eddie Smith. All righty, we're going to move on to some questions, and looking forward to taking a look at these with you. All right, how can small OEMs manage obsolescence from Troy, Deuce, and Bobcat?
Yeah, so you know, the bigger companies have some ways. They have balance sheets they can leverage to fix obsolescence or sometimes avoid obsolescence. They don't like to use their balance sheet that way, but sometimes they have to. And it solves the problem. Smaller OEMs don't have these balance sheets to do that. So their information has to be more exact. Their decisions have to be more important, right? A small OEM could have a key and critical product line that something goes obsolete and there's no way to work around it. And if they have to be out of business for 6 months, a year, while they redesign or recertify, this can be disaster. So my answer is, if you're a small OEM, be as involved as possible on the upfront on the engineering with your engineers. Second, get as much information as possible. That means have meetings with the key constituents at the supplier on are they going to build this? Are they at risk? Are they making money? Here's a question I always find that nobody ever asks. It's probably the most key question. How many customers buy this part other than me? And when they say, oh, no, you're the only one who buys this part. We're making it special for you because they want you to feel special. What do you think the first part that gets obsoleted? The one that you're special, right? Nobody likes special. So when companies buy other companies, they say, hey, only one customer will affect only one customer by making this change. Guess what we'll do? We'll make the change. So the first thing I would ask is let my software be the differentiator and let my hardware be agnostic. And if you do that, you're going to have less obsolescence in doing that. If you're a small OEM, my answer would be I would look at more embedded computing and have your software be your features, advantages, benefits, and less specialty hardware.
Outstanding, Eddie.
Is Troy here? I was going to say, did I answer your question? But Troy left the building.
All righty, we'll go with, how can EMS partners be used to proactively watch for obsolescence, test and qualify alternatives, and manage risks from knock at CFID?
My initial reaction is to say we don't, but that would irritate all our customers. The reality is we get these PCNs. We pass them along to our customers. I can tell you many of our customers have teams like you where they'll go actually action them real quickly and say, yes, this affects us. No, it doesn't affect us. Or they'll ask us, is there an alternative? What should we do? Can you design it? Can you change it for us? Can you do the testing? Can you do this? Can you do that? And my answer always is yes. But I would also tell you, there's always risk at taking that engineering function and moving it to your EMS house. They say yes, and if something goes wrong, guess what the engineer EMS house says? Well, you told me to do that. But your end customer is not mad at the EMS house, they're mad at you. So my answer here is, we should be the alert or the red light that something's going on, but ultimately there has to be a process between your EMS provider and you on an ongoing basis that says, when parts are at risk to go end of life, and you know, somebody's just been bought, something's just changed in the industry, the answer has to be, what could that effect be? And let's pre-plan it before it becomes a crisis.
How do we do that, Nock? Do I hear an okay? All righty, let's go ahead to our open questions. And let's see the hands go up. This is a great resource. Somebody's got to be brave. Here we go. Do we have one over here? So I have one for Ed while you guys get brave out there. You've seen the industry from one end to the other. When it comes to communication gridlock, is there any one point that's the worst?
I think there's a couple different spots that become more critical ever. One is the very beginning quoting, because you're taking information, but it's still going to take months and months to build. And so things change from here to here. And people don't take that into account, that things will change. So when they go to build, they go, oh, well, why didn't you tell me that when you quoted? Well, that was 3 months ago or 4 months ago or something has changed. So I think the initial quoting is always difficult. The second part that always breaks down is, and I've gotten this many times in my career, hey, the engineers don't want to see you. It's only their time to build product. Well, but if I can't build it because something's not right, then you can't build it. So I would say access to engineers is the second place it goes really poorly. And then third is, if you're relying on a distributor or anybody else to be your advocate only inside the BU of a supplier, you're shortchanging yourself. You guys, many of you are customers that matter, and you need to have relationships in the supplier.
Outstanding, Andy. Thank you. We got a question right over here. Please say who you are.
Roy at X Labs. We manufacture veterinary instrumentation that we sell in the EU and other countries. And one of the communications issues that we have a lot is between our regulatory folks and our design engineers as far as compliance management. And we run into a lot of situations where we're compliant in one place, but we're selling an instrument that's compliant one place and not compliant in another place. How do you suggest curing that communication breakdown?
Yeah, we have a team of people that work. So I'll use, somebody had asked about tariffs. Somebody had asked, how do you avoid tariffs, or is there a way to avoid tariffs? And when the tariff issue first came on, our risk was about $14.8 million worth of tariffs. Last year, we paid less than $1 million. So we were able to find either other sources, same source, but they built it a different factory, and we'd say, we require you to build in a different factory, and there's ways. Very similar to this compliance. You have to take your bomb, and you have to have some experts both in supply chain and regulatory issues. So we have an engineer, both a quality engineer and a regular engineer. They're regulatory experts for different. One's a military aerospace expert, and one is a medical expert. And they're pretty good at the general, what I would call the REACH, all the other Rojas and all the other ones, too, that fall into those categories. You have to have them do, when I say DFX, that's part of the DFX. They got to go through and say, you're at risk at this, you're at risk at this. And the customer has to tell us where they're shipping product for us to know where they're at risk. Some customers will say, don't worry about it, we'll handle that. And then they come back to us later and say, uh-oh, that's a problem. My answer is, if we can solve it up front, it normally is an easy solution. But sometimes, if you don't solve it until you've already built something, fixing it is much more difficult.
Yeah, we're playing a lot of catch-up.
Yeah, I'd be more than happy to help you any way I can help you. I'll give you my card. Feel free to help you there.
Outstanding. Thanks, Eddie. We have another one here. Please say who you are.
Robert Lopez, Weiser Engineering Laboratories. You showed some tools on your presentation, and specifically I'm referring to your parts monitoring or risk tools. And as we know, a lot of those tools, they give you different information, sometimes current, sometimes not, sometimes incorrect. But for you, I'm assuming that you use those tools probably in tandem or in some kind of sequence. What does that use flow look like for you?
Yeah, so we use multiple tools because I don't think any one tool is perfect out there yet. That's, you know, some would argue with me. Maybe the people who presented earlier would say, hey, one tool's perfect. I haven't found that. And some of it's timing of when information gets put in, put out. So we use multiple tools. We use the tools primarily when we do a DFX. So bomb comes in, customer asks us for a quote. I normally will say we won't quote this until we run a DFX on your bomb. And the customers normally get frustrated with that, say, just give me a quote and I'll let you know if you should run a DFX if you win it. And my answer is, when I win it, and then you hand it to me for a DFX, it's gonna be really difficult because it may change the price, it may change this. Let me run a DFX, it'll take 2 weeks, and we'll be able to help you. That's been pretty, to be honest with you, it's been pretty successful. Customers like, because when we go back with, hey, here's parts you should think about not using, it's not always don't use them, it's you should think about it. You know, they appreciate that you're not giving them just a price, you're actually giving them a service. So we normally do it right on the upfront when we do our DFX, and it runs through. We run it through a couple different tools.
Okay, that's about all the time we have. Thank you, Eddie. Please give it up for Eddie Smith.
Thank you. Thanks, sir.